The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. There we go. Yeah. Easier said than done.
Yeah, come on, get with it.
My name's Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And we're here with our guest.
Ray Help.
We are goofy.
It's like a sad comedy routine.
And that was Jackson Brown.
Pretty bad.
Jackson Brown, my redneck friend. I don't know why we picked that song. It just seemed funny. Like 6 years ago. Had I known it was going to play for this long, I think, I don't know, I guess we should have thought about it more. But we like it. Anyway, all right, today we've got a big, big topic. We actually posted the list of what we're going to talk about today, which is always dangerous because, well, most of the time we have this gigantic list and then, you know,
we
barely scratch the surface and then we got to do it all again. Another really super serious topic where you're probably going to get mad. Going to try to have as much fun as possible because it's about fire. And Lord knows it's a treasure trove of musical joy for Bob. There's like tons of fire music, right?
No shortage of that.
That's kind of what I thought.
and we've all got to experience the aftermath of the fire here in what, the last 2-3 weeks?
Oh my gosh.
It's like...
Well, it's the during math. I mean, it's not gone yet.
No.
It's and still
everybody,
happening.
Everybody out there has their own opinion of this, too.
That's true. So,
just
all right.
It's a smoky day every day, it seems like.
So here on the West Coast, we're having a lot of fire. Those of you in the rest of the universe, you hear about it, you see it on the news, but you might not know all of the things that surround that. So I guess I should tell you, we air live every Sunday from noon to 2 here on the West Coast. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. During that time, there's a chat window open, and so you can talk back and forth with us. On Mondays, we air in Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore on WNJC 1360, and that's Mondays from 1 to 3. We're now airing both hours in Philadelphia. So, in deference to our folks in Philadelphia who are thinking, we don't care about your fires out there, I mean, okay, be politically incorrect to say that out loud, but they're thinking it. I can hear them thinking it, like, so who cares?
We don't live there.
You idiots. Yeah. Living in California. Okay, so why do you care about the topic if you don't live here and you don't have to breathe it? Because you get to pay for it.
Yeah.
Woohoo.
Yeah, we thank you very much.
We're going to talk about the cost of this because it's driven by policy. We've got some serious policy problems, and your guys are voting on policy that affects us that you get stuck paying for. I mean, nobody gets away from anybody on this. Nobody gets out free. All Americans are losing national treasure. So all the things that you see that are public land that you think are set aside for you and your kids to go on vacation to see, you know, Yosemite, Yellowstone, Banff, I don't care where you go. If we burn it all up, you can come. You might as well just, like, look at pictures of the moon because that's what a lot of it looks like. You're going to pay the cost in your wood products. I don't care where you live. You use toilet paper, you know, you make furniture, you got houses, you've got all sorts of things that are wood products and byproduct, and that's burning up too. So as we just burn that up, you get to pay more for what's left. And I guess...
But it's not only a public land issue, though.
Of course, and a lot of it's private land, too.
If you live near a forest or if you have land adjacent to a public land...
It's a super personal issue.
Well, try and buy insurance on your property to protect your resource.
You're right.
You know, you're living
right.
With a
It's like
real,
living in a floodplain.
That's right.
Just different kind of flood.
Yeah.
As Ray brought up, the last little bullet point we added to this show was out here in the West, we're tired of breathing your green dream. Your green ecologies.
It's going up in smoke for sure.
It's screwing up our lungs.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I thought I was sick yesterday. I thought I was getting sick. And I think it was just the smoke.
Yeah.
The day before, I mean, everybody's eyes are burning, and God forbid you live right next to it. For one, your place is burning up. Mm-hmm. But these guys are all worried about air pollution.
Yeah.
Well, if you think it looks good in China, you ought to come out here.
Yeah.
Same deal.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're not supposed to breathe that stuff in L.A. from the old smog from the 60s and 70s. this is many times worse.
Yeah, they didn't ever see smog like this. This is a whole new... And it's a big particulate.
It is.
I mean, it isn't... Like, people with allergies have a problem. Everybody's got allergies when this rolls in. And it's funny, you know, you go outside and it's like, you kind of taste it a little bit, you know?
Yeah, it's thick. Yeah. Well, you sent me that picture last week. If you didn't know what time of year it was, it looked like a kind of a cold, foggy day over Lake Whiskey
Lake
Town.
Anything.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a smoke layer laying down. You couldn't even see across the water, and it was completely smoked in.
Well, I drove up to Whiskey Town, Weaverville, up through Whiskey Town, and it's you're right in all the mountains. And normally you drive into Weaverville and you're surrounded by mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what, might as well have been in Texas.
Sure.
It looked like, I mean, it was just a street. That's all you could see, was just a street. So a big factor of this is we're causing this ourselves.
Yeah, and I don't want to diminish the fact that fires ever present.
Things happen.
In our ecosystems. They have been forever.
Sure.
But what I hope we can talk about a little bit today is what's different today than how this functioned for, well, without our intervention. How's that?
Yeah, without us helping.
Yeah, without
us please
helping.
Stop helping.
Yeah, if we look back, you know, in fire history, you know, fires were of the magnitude we have today were infrequent. You know, we look at the fire history and million acre fires, excuse me, were pretty rare in every 300-400 years. But what we're seeing now is half million acre fires with recurring severity and recurring frequency every few years. And there's a lot of reasons for that, a lot of science around that. You know, years ago, the bulk of those very large fires were precipitated by normally a period of drought, which is what we're experiencing out here. The drought's not unusual. It's been there forever. But what's uniquely different is back then, lightning fires didn't usually start these large fires like we see today, because the fuels were very different. The bulk of the fires we saw starting back there were largely industrial in nature, man-made, you know, started by man, man's activities, and they got very big.
Well, remember we were kids? Hmm? That was always, you know.
I try to forget that part.
Smoking.
That's
okay. So, that was fun when I was a kid.
That was terrible.
Well, I didn't say we were good kids. I just said it was fun. It was fun for us. But, it was always people. That's all you ever heard about was a campfire, you know, somebody's campfire, that kind of thing.
Yeah. There were a few.
Did we have arsonists back then? Were we just Were we just clueless about arsonists?
Oh, we did.
Bill's an arsonist. What am I thinking?
Well, when I was a kid,
tried. tried my hand at it.
As a small child, Bill.
We look at, on the West Coast, the Tillamook Fire, that was largely from about Alsea, Oregon, all the way up to almost Astoria. Along the coastal range. That fire began as an industrial accident from logging operation, actually, in that area. And then it was encouraged by a couple of arsonists a few days later.
Oh, they piled on?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, you don't really have these big fires in the East.
No.
In other places. The trees are, it's just different.
Well, the landscape's broken up. You know, there's lots of cities.
Yeah.
There's lots of highways and lots of different kinds of vegetation.
And they have a lot more moisture.
Yeah, you don't have the continuous vegetation that you do out here on the West Coast.
And we didn't either, did we?
Naturally,
we didn't have this.
It was different.
We had meadows and things like that.
Well, if you look at Eric Knapp's research that's going back in the Sierras and reestablishing what Duncan Dunning did back in the 1930s, we see that those historic conditions in the Sierra and in Northern California had about 25% openness, and it wasn't all in one place. You know, it was patches here and there, and large trees with very little underbrush in it because there were frequent small fires that kept most of that beet down. But now what we've done is...
Well, we did a lot of grazing, too.
Well, we did a lot of grazing, and let's face it, we were coming off of 8,000 years of Native American burning, and then settler burning followed that for about a 100-year period.
Oh. And then we just pulled the plug on everything.
Yeah, my great former agency stopped that. 1934... the U.S. Forest Service, because it was put to protect the resource in place, issued a letter that demanded that all of the range burning and forest burning stop because they were burning up some trees. And what that precipitated was a dramatic increase in growth.
Then we had tree hugging.
Well, we had a lot more before that, too. We started industrial fire operations right after World War II, when things okay. started to become effective. And then, you know, we were managing forests like we should have to kind of mimic natural disasters or natural maintenance structures, actually, with fire in the forest. And we did that up until about, I'd say probably about 1985, 88. Doing a pretty good job of that.
Magic the Clintons.
Yeah, here we go. Then the timber war started on the West Coast. And the litigation started, and pretty much all of the industry-related stuff in the forest stopped. And what that did is it predisposed our forest from the standpoint that we stopped managing right at the time when we really needed to manage second-growth timber, the small stuff. Which burns really nice.
Oh, yeah.
Because prior to that period, the old growth piece, we're converting everything to second growth in the forest so that we could do high production on that and retool all the mills. But all of a sudden, that quit. So that predisposed the whole landscape at that point in time to these fires. And then couple that with a change in climate coming out of a 100-year wet cycle where you're artificially more dense than you should be.
Yep.
And... perfect recipe for what we have
today. A
little
dryness roll in and everybody stand back. And
the other thing most people forget about, too, is early in my career, back in the 70s, with the number of loggers and woods crews that were in the forest, they were on top of a fire long before the agency got there.
That's true. We had people there.
Yeah, that's not there anymore. So the response time is, instead of 30 minutes, you're talking 3-4 hours sometimes.
Yeah, we've gotten rid of a lot of those roads and caused people not to be out there.
Taking the equipment and the people out of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because a lot of that same equipment that's out there harvesting timber is used to fight fire.
Same thing.
Yep, same stuff.
Yeah.
And people who know the area well.
That's right.
Got to take a quick break here. We're going to come back. We're chatting with Ray Haupt this morning. He'll give you a little bit of his bio when we come back. Thank our advertisers. Thank Bob. Give you time to get on the site. There's a ton of information on there, by the way. WeThePeopleRadio.us. That silence brought to you by... Oh, no. Killing my segue, Bob.
Okay, this priest walks into a bar.
Okay, a match walks into the forest.
Yeah, it would be easier to find that gold if you had to navigate all those darn trees. Just burn them down.
Just burn them all down.
Burn them all down.
Yeah, we got a little fire on our mountain out here. This topic we set up kind of a long time ago. I guess it was. We didn't have to be clairvoyant to know that it might be fire season.
Might reoccur.
Yeah, we might be having a fire.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see. Let me flip back here. So you spent. Rahab spent 33 years in the Forest Service.
Yeah, and what's not on that resume is my involvement with fire.
Yeah. You're now a county supervisor.
I am.
In the area where you were a district ranger.
Correct.
So, okay, just to give people a little. And I also, did I do it? Yes, I did. I clicked the previous show. You've got a little link on there from July 12th. So if you want to hear the, I don't know if it was really the first half. What were we talking about back then? Something.
Fire.
No, but we wanted to. We were like, it's a different show.
No, we were talking about the...
I think we were just talking about forest stuff.
Just forest policy and Endangered Species Act and those
kinds
of things.
That's right.
Yeah. We might get to some of that again today.
Because you know? it's all part and parcel of the same issue.
Yeah.
Okay, so now what were you doing with fire when you were in the Forest Service?
Well, I spent the bulk of my career in, as a forester, but as a forester with an agency like that, it's the best of both worlds. In private industry, you're doing forestry, and that's it.
And what does that mean? Like, for people who live in a city, when somebody says, I'm a forester, they're like, no.
Yeah, well, you
know. It brings nothing to mind.
It's the one position.
The Subaru.
Exactly.
Yeah, really. It's the one position for land management agencies that is professionally taught in all of the science disciplines and not just a narrow field like wildlife biology or hydrology or something like that. We have, you know, we do focus a lot of study in the science of growing trees, basically, which has a lot of economics, a lot of investment, business principles associated with that. But then we're the ones that have to try and blend all of these, you know, this specialist wants that and that specialist wants this, and we kind of have to sit there and try and pull this together so that one science doesn't outstep another.
Winds up being patchwork quilt.
Yeah, and do something that isn't within the bounds of what the vegetation and the landscape can do.
Oh. Yeah, so no imaginary application like some of these restoration plans. Let's return it to a time and place that it never was.
Well, let's pick one.
Exactly.
Which one would you pick?
Let's pick what we like the most and retool it all.
Right. Or let's just ignore it all and hope it doesn't go sideways on you.
Yeah, it's not working out very well either.
But what I was going to say is that beyond being a forester, the other part that I did was I chose to be involved in fire. So I did. I've participated in or written and managed prescriptions for over 1 million acres of prescribed fire.
That's if we're going to burn it on purpose.
Yeah.
Not to decimate it, but to kind of clean up the undergrowth.
Just clean it up. Yeah.
I was on a fire team myself for about 5 years, permanently on a team here in California, and I did logistics work, and I did I was a division soup in operations. And local stuff got up to an incident commander type three. Basically, so I have real in-depth knowledge. And later on in my career, when all of us get old and look at those mountains and say, young man's sport or young woman's sport, I worked directly for the regional office in Vallejo for the Forest Service doing policy interpretation and policy implementation on a team directly related to fire.
And so, you know, that, I guess that leads us to kind of the bigger question, because I know different states have different things, but out here we have CAL FIRE, and then we also have the Forest Service that has firefighting capability.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, depending on the experience people have had or who they know or, you know, the things they've been told, people think, well, we should just have one. We should just let CAL FIRE fight all the fires, and, you know, what's the Forest Service, they're a bunch of knuckleheads.
Yeah.
But they're really different.
Very different. Different laws, different missions. CAL FIRE's primary role is protection of life and property on private land.
I mean, is that the same? Do most states have a state fire agency? Is that pretty common?
Most do, except for some of the East Coast where I've worked, they're less fire-oriented and more management-oriented.
The state agency?
The state agency.
So the state would be more trained in protection of structures and property, whereas Forest Service is more...
Yeah, Forest Service is actually forbidden to do structure protection unless it's an immediate threat that you cannot get someone else to do. So
got a cabin out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and their primary role is fire behavior in the upland and how to modify that and suppress that. And that's very different. The other different major difference between the two is when the public land agencies are fighting fire, they have to ascribe to all of that Endangered Species Act, all the rest of that layer of bureaucracy associated with
that. But your state fire agencies, I mean, you're not going to run to a town that's, you know, the fire's burning towards a town.
No.
You don't have to sit around and figure out what endangered species are there.
No. Now they will, when they're on public land, they do the same thing. Or if there's something listed on state land that they know about, that they have protocols that they have to follow as well. But it's not their they're not left with having to clean that up afterwards.
Oh.
Okay. They don't live with the action.
Okay.
So there's a different mindset.
The other thing too is with, you know, all these people think these wilderness areas are wonderful.
Yeah.
And magical, et cetera, et cetera. So they designate something a wilderness area, and again, people who maybe don't have to deal with that on the ground think that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
What is it when you turn public land into a wilderness area? You can't build roads there.
True.
You can't use any machinery there.
Except in emergency situations, but there's really limitations on it. A lot
and so then if there's a fire that burns from regular Forest Service land, say, onto a wilderness area, what happens? Or doesn't happen?
Well,
everybody gets on their Birkenstocks
depends.
And their hemp shirts?
I mean, I'll tell you, it's fairly agency-specific. Depends on whether you're asking that question of the Park Service, which takes the most liberal interpretation of wilderness, or if you talk to the Forest Service, which takes the more conservative.
And Cal Fire wouldn't fight on wilderness.
They wouldn't be there anyway.
They wouldn't go there.
Hard to get an engine in wilderness.
Right.
You know, they may support with a crew, you know, a CDC crew or something like that, but typically not, unless it's an aerial
support. I was going to say, what about aerial support?
Yeah, they will.
They will fight it?
They will do that if it's a unified command situation where they're engaged. But that doesn't happen very often unless you have a wilderness boundary bump right up against a big private property boundary or something like that.
Hmm. So if you have to fight fire on a wilderness area, what are your tools?
Shovel? Well, that's where you start. And then depending on the fire itself, you try and make the most of natural barriers and things like that aid in the suppression, because the prevailing thought in wilderness is whatever action you take in suppression is much longer lasting than the fire itself on the land.
Okay. Is that true?
It is true if we hadn't altered the landscape to begin with.
Yeah, because I'm like, wait a minute. Yeah. Some of it is so loaded up that...
Yeah, yeah, if you don't stop it, it'll...
The wilderness purist would say... we should have never suppressed fire to begin with in wilderness, and we wouldn't have the situation we have right now. And I tend to believe that a little bit, with some reason. Often when you set something aside or you do something, there's always an unintended consequence.
Sure.
I really don't think...
Overhelping?
Yeah. In 1965, I don't think Congress thought that through clearly about what to do with fire. Because the wilderness law itself says natural processes will be allowed to dominate.
Mm.
Okay? So it's hard then...
Could be fire.
Fire is, in the West, is one of the most predominant natural processes.
Yeah, most of the fires that we're looking at now are all lightning fires. However, what if you have a arson fire in a wilderness area? Is that going to be considered a natural process?
No, they're suppressed instantly.
Okay.
Yeah. By policy. Now the problem with the lightning fires is from 1965 to about the early 2000s, they were all suppressed as well. So it allowed that landscape to get to the even worse condition than the managed landscape outside of it. And so I would advocate at this point, without putting fire back in from a prescribed fire standpoint, to control vegetation and put it and try and reset that clock. You're dealing with an anomaly that didn't exist prior to the wilderness designation.
But can you really reintroduce fire into a large area like that. I mean, that some of those wilderness areas are thousands and thousands and thousands of acres. You can't go in there and burn the whole thing, can you?
No. You know, if you'd asked me that question in 1930, I'd have said no big deal.
Right.
Because it wasn't all loaded up.
No, it wasn't all loaded up. The Frank Church Wilderness up in, I think it's Montana, Idaho, the largest wilderness in the system, is often used as the example of what natural fire can do in the wilderness, because it really was never suppressed.
Right.
And it's so large and there's nothing around it to speak of. The fire just kind of does its thing.
So it runs through, burns up the grass and some of the lower little stuff, but it doesn't just leave it.
No. No, and then when you try and bring that methodology of that mindset to the San Bernardino that has a wilderness with a city limit almost adjacent to the wilderness, that just doesn't work because of the public safety threats.
Well, now, what about like Yosemite when it caught on fire? It was a lot of folks were saying that that was due to poor management, there was a lot of fuels built up in Yosemite.
Yeah,
it burned it to the ground.
Yeah, there are, and you know, the key with all of, to me, I was a real expert in wilderness managed fire.
Really?
Okay? Yes. And the key to all that is when to burn and when not, and the
like time of year, amount of growth,
fuels condition, the moisture in the fuels, the prediction of weather, all of those things. Where did it start on the slope? Where is it in proximity to a town? Where is this wilderness? Because they all are different, and their fire behavior is all different, and so is the meteorology that affects those fires. So I guess what I'm saying is, prior to me ever doing any of that personally as a line officer for the Forest Service, I actually spent about 5 years with really highly technical teams gaming that out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it wasn't something you just kind of willy nilly, you know, stumble into.
Let's go light it and see where it goes.
And at the time,
that seemed to be a process here recently that went a couple of times. Like,
yeah. And that's kind of what I'm getting at.
You know, DLM, their controlled burn on like 40 mile an hour wind day when it's 105.
First one I did was in 2006 in the Marble Mountains, and that was a 6 month event.
Really?
Yeah, 6 months, and. Wasn't all that expensive, but I can tell you, I had a team of computer geeks working 24/7 doing predictive services on fire behavior and weather and you know, risk assessment and all those things coming up to be able to predict with some kind of, you know, better than a guess kind of certainty.
Like, are you okay to leave it run?
Yeah, or do we take an action here versus over here, and that kind of thing to herd it around?
Turn it.
Yeah, and that kind of thing. But at that time, I also was able to assemble a national team that, like, there were a handful of people that could actually do this in the nation. So for the agency to go where it's gone today, I believe is irresponsible. It's not a product of waking up one morning and we'll go, hey, we're just going to do this policy. I think it's a symptom of not being able to do things.
Sure, they get sued for everything.
Yeah,
we're gonna cut. I mean, even up where you are, what, 4% of a massive burn area?
Yeah, 4%.
Just to harvest the trees that are going to be dead or dying.
Yep.
And so that they're usable.
Impossible to get through the regulatory structure and then get through the courts on top of that.
Can't do it.
Yeah, it's nuts. But what I guess what I'm saying is that to then go ahead and do that one thing, because that was the only thing that was going on nationally at the time. To take that and say we're going to do that anywhere in the nation on multiple forests at the same time, I don't think is well thought out.
Yeah. Well, and yet we can't just sit there and, you know, Not do anything.
Yeah. So you know. So what do you do? At this point, you have to aggressively attack every fire,
mm-hmm.
especially with the weather conditions. And 2006 were not the weather conditions we're having right now.
True.
So
it's gotten really, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Dry. And you know, I would never contemplate that mm-hmm. today in this weather. excuse me.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
In the drought cycle that we're in, so. I guess what I'm getting at, so you have to attack aggressively everything, put it out, and then...
Which is not manageable.
And then maybe have this discussion again in 5 years when we have El Ninos and things back in place when this drought subsides, kind of a thing. The statistics are that if they get on a fire within the first 24 hours, they have there's about a 98% chance of extinguishing that fire. It's only the 2% that get to the fires that are problematic like this if there was aggressive initial attack.
No kidding.
Yeah. But you have to temper that with a standpoint, and we'll get into the fire response mechanisms here in a bit and the structure.
Speaking of the drought.
But yeah, in my throat.
Let's take a quick break. Right. We'll let Ray handle the drought over there.
Right.
He's having his own personal climate change. I thought that was just girls. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Oh, yeah, I worked in menopause. That's pretty good, huh?
That's good.
Oh, my gosh. We'll be right back.
You'll always be a fire I can't put out. I don't know how to handle the dream you left behind. It's like a lighted candle burning up my mind. At least I'm happy. What love's all about. You'll always be a fire I can't put out.
Inappropriate that we laugh at these things, but we can't help it.
I love that song.
We are who we are.
Yeah.
We're just inappropriate. Oh my gosh. So, okay, on the break. I had written 25% on my notebook, but but I didn't finish my note.
Okay.
So I was asking Ray, why did I write that down? So we had talked at the very beginning about 25% of the land basically didn't have trees on it or had new trees.
Correct.
And that moved around. It wasn't the same 25%.
Right.
Just kept shifting around. But approximately at any given time, you could take a bird's eye view and you'd get 25% of our forested land that was open.
And it changes with elevation. But that's,
sure.
You know, those are general statements.
Yeah. Okay, so what did it do to fire?
Well, what it did to fire is it forced the fire to drop to the ground. You know, because the fire behavior, you look at fire behavior, you have to have fuels in continuity. For the fire behavior to be unchanging. And what you're always looking for is some modification of fire behavior to be able to suppress it.
So when it dropped to the ground...
When it dropped to the ground, you could actually get a tool on it versus running through the ground, through the crowns
right.
Above your head, which is kind of what's going on right now because we have this giant clone of the same age class across the entire landscape. So we were talking about management, you know, the prevailing thought in forestry in the generation that was trained before me was that we need to maximize growth on every acre and get the most amount of boards per acre produced for the American public. And that was the goal of forestry. That is the definition, actually, still of industrialized forestry. That's practiced mainly on flat ground in the southeast part of the U.S.
And that works depending on your terrain and your goal and
depends
how you're
going to
do it.
Yeah.
It's a renewable resource.
It's a maximization of the growing potential of every acre.
And as long as you follow through with the harvest plan, that's
correct.
Fine. But when you stop the harvest plan,
correct.
Now you've got a mess.
Because you suppress the fire,
and at
stop
that point,
the harvest.
What you're doing is you're looking at an investment. An investment that you enter into in year zero, and you carry that interest forward through at least 60 years. And on public lands, it's 120 for a rotation before it's cut. So getting away from that, what we as foresters, and I won't say we because I was trained after that to recognize natural processes and ecosystems and those kinds of things. But what we did is we took the old growth off of the scattered parcels, so to speak, the other 75% that was scattered here and about. And then on the 25% that had young stuff on it or brush, we converted all that to plantations. And we normalized, if you will, the same age class across the entire landscape.
So everything's the same size.
Same size, same fire behavior.
So you get a good wind.
You get a good wind.
You get to burn it all down all at the same time.
In a drought, and you're in an overcrowded condition already, you have tremendous potential for large fire growth.
Mm-hmm.
And with that extra production on the ground, you have more trees on the ground, fewer meadows. I remember you had told me a long time ago to consider too what happens when it snows.
Sure.
You don't have any snowpack.
Yeah,
it doesn't hit the ground.
Look at Roger Bales and the work that he's doing, Dr. Bales from UC Merced, and we're doing some of this up in the Klamath Mountains. You'll see that the forests that we've studied so far from 1930s on are four times the density that they were today than what they were historically in the 30s. And across every acre, which has eliminated basically the ability to pack snow.
Because it never gets to the ground.
Because it never gets to the ground. In most ecosystems at the higher elevations where the snow falls, if snow intercepts a canopy, you lose about 70% of it directly back into the atmosphere, the moisture. Just hangs up and melts and evaporates right back. Then you have the additional transpiration from the trees themselves from being too dense and stressed. And all of a sudden, guess what? You have really low flows in your streams. I mean, I hate to
the,
you know
the trees
that term.
Need
this
the
isn't
water.
This
yeah.
isn't rocket science. It
no,
really isn't, but it is science.
Mm-hmm.
And we have severely dysfunctional hydrologic systems because of how the landscape's been altered from historic.
So then you get a seasonal drought like we've been having.
It sets up the whole system then for Mother Nature to reset itself. And that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can do that with forest management and control the effect, or we can live with Mother Nature's
fury. We can just
fury.
Roll the dice like we're doing now.
Yeah. And, the big difference is in forestry, we practice recovering that site. I'm not going to talk about clear cuts, but I'm talking about thinnings. When we do a thinning, we want that forest to come back to a similar state within 20 years. After it's
that's the plan.
That's the plan. That's the not a goal, but that is the design of modern silvicultural prescriptions. And for Mother Nature to do it, and you have stand replacing fire like we have today, we're talking 300-400 years.
Because it's burned so hot and so deep,
and you've sterilized the soil in the process. So everybody says, well, it's natural. Yeah, it is. So are volcanic eruptions, glaciers. Depends what you want to live with.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
But we have somebody in the chat that brought up a good point. The advertising on television says, only you can prevent forest fires.
Yeah.
And that 90% of wildfires are human caused. Do you agree with that statement?
Depends where you are. If you're around an urban area, that's probably the case. And that's really bastardized, probably isn't the term, but swayed. The statistic is swayed from a national perspective because of the high incident of fires that are started back east by man. That is, if you're not along the East Coast, Florida, Alabama, Texas, where they get a lot of lightning, it is man that starts most of the fires.
Right. So it's a real regional.
It is regional. And that's what I'm going to say about all of our discussion here. You know, you can't take, you know, everybody has a perception of fire, but even me, I'm talking about one, but I can tell you that if you asked me these same questions and I were sitting in Spokane, my answers will be different, because fire is different, as are the trees and the systems that live with it.
Oh, okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, and same too with the terrain.
Right.
I mean, you see, that's a huge factor in a lot of these places.
And just here, fire behavior, say west of I-5, after you go north of Redding, the fire behavior is driven by three things, basically. But primarily, any fire is driven by topography and fuel continuity. Mm-hmm. And then it's exacerbated by moisture conditions associated with drought or other weather things that go on. You go to the east side of Interstate 5 as you go north and east of the Cascades, the driving force is wind. And because wind has to drive the fire, because the fuel continuity isn't as tight as it is in the more moisture-laden forests west of Interstate 5.
Right. I heard the other day that the big fire they have over in Lake County, they said they haven't had a fire over there in like 40 years, and that's one of the reasons it's so hot and moving so fast, is there's just tons of and real tall fuel on the ground.
Well, we can talk about fire reentry. You'll hear that fire reentry interval.
Mm-hmm. So it's been suppressed for a long period of time?
Yeah, suppressed for a long period of time. When you get to missing 4 and 5 fire departures around here, you have some pretty conflagration kind of conditions. And what I'm saying is that in the science in north of Redding is about every 15 years, fire will visit an acre.
Unless you're in Happy Valley.
Yeah. Well, but see, you're in a different fire regime there.
Okay.
You're in a 5-year fire That's frequency.
5-minute fire frequency.
Well,
historically, that was 5 years. But what I'm saying is, and this isn't too hard to figure out, all you have to do is study the brush. And west of Interstate 5, you're going north, Manzanita and the other brush species start building dead material in their crown at about 12 years. And when you get to 15, it'll start carrying a fire again.
Oh, okay.
So that's why the... And then all you're waiting for is lightning. And so that's why it's 15 to 20 years.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. On that note, see, there's a lot of this that actually does. It's not really the crapshoot that we think it is. You know, where you just sit around and go, "Oh, gee, I hope we don't get lightning." I mean, some of this.
Well, there are a lot of unknowns. I mean, why don't we have big fires this year on the Klamath like we had last year? Well, what I've been doing is I've been studying the energy release components and the 10-year or the 10-hour fuels, 100-hour fuels, and 1,000-hour fuels. They're not where they were last year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier to suppress a fire. And without the occurrence of fire, you're just not going to get them.
Nice. Well, you guys get a break then. What a pleasant change.
Yeah.
What a pleasant change for you.
Yeah, we'll hold our breath.
Exactly. All right. We're going to talk about a little fire here in a minute. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Not about you, Bill.
when I did start the fire.
I know, that's why I said this song is not about you.
No.
This is for Ray and Bob and I, not you.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Tons of information on today's page. Tons. Okay. So in the break, we were talking. See, we have a lot of fun on the break, actually. Then we have to tell you what we talked about. We always say that.
We have to zip our lips on the break.
On the break, we talked about
this. That's where Aaron gets to put me back on track.
That's right. Where that's where I'm like, okay, what about this? What about that? All right, so you were saying that on flatland we should have fire every...
Well, down here...
Well, in real life you would
down
normally.
Here around Redding, you know, the fire return interval was 1 to 5 years.
Because the grass
would grow up.
We have digger pine, we have, you know...
Yeah, you know, digger pine itself will not regenerate even in the presence of grass.
Really?
So it's completely intolerant to any shade at all. So when you start seeing brush around the lower lands here in the presence of digger pine and or ghost pine, whatever you want to call it these days, you've got something that's severely departed from normal fire interval.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So it would normally just whip through every few years, not be that big of a deal. Wouldn't burn the trees down, I guess, is my...
No. No,
the thing people
just,
need to know.
Grass-driven, grass fires, very fast-moving, very low heat residency, so to speak. It doesn't take very long to move through.
Doesn't burn your whole town down.
No, just, it's a flash, you know. Play that song, too.
Yeah. Off it goes.
Yeah.
And then in the higher elevations with more, in the more mountainous.
Yeah, and once you start up off the valley floor here, and I'm thinking when you start north and you start to hit where the dam is, then you'd have brush.
Sure.
You know, because that's a transition zone between the grassland down here in the valley and then to the forested zone above, and it's a moisture gradient, basically, and temperature gradient.
Okay, and you were talking about John Muir, too. That was an interesting little piece.
Yeah, you know, I was reading some historic stuff recently, and John Muir was lamenting about how beautiful it was in the Sierra, being able to ride through the Sierra unobstructed by trees and see for miles on horseback.
And where can you do that now? Nowhere.
Maybe in the rocks above Lake Tahoe.
So
there's some terrain outside, out near Siskiyou County that...
A quarter of a billion acres, actually.
It's kind of black,
got pretty good viewing.
Yeah, you got a lot of good views up there.
Yeah, great stuff.
Nice. All right, so in our last minute and a half of this hour,
uh-huh.
All right, what are we going to talk about next hour? Because, we had a really long list.
Yeah.
We have this really super long list. Actually, we're like halfway through it.
Let's wrap this ecology stuff and move into more of the fire
the politics.
The fire industrial machine kind of thing. To wrap the fire ecology and that kind of thing, one thing that we haven't discussed is what is the difference with the fire today versus the fire even of my youth 40 years ago? The difference is that historically fires moving through the northern mountains of California had about, which mimics the Sierra, 25% high severity fire.
Oh.
Or actually less. Around 20. But it was really important where it occurred. It occurred in the upper third of the slope. Now we're having stand replacing fire, which is high severity fire, at any elevation. That's very uncharacteristic of the natural...
So we've messed up the way it should normally work.
That's a management problem.
Greatly altered the way fire behavior and our ecosystems function.
And we haven't talked about the money. When we come back, we're talking about money, because this is the part where your wallet cries out for help.
Yeah.
WeThePeopleRadio.us. Be right back.